International.
Ici Radio Canada. This is Canada.
This is Radio Nederland, the Dutch World Broadcasting System in Hilversum, Holland.
You're tuned to Swiss Radio International in Bern.
This is Free China as a presentation of the Voice of Free China, the international service of the Broadcasting Corporation of China.
This is Radio Havana, Cuba.
Broadcasting from Cuba, free territory in the Americas.
This is Radio South Africa.
This is Yugoslavia Radio Belgrade calling.
This is Israel broadcasting from Jerusalem.
This is Radio Pyongyang of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea.
This is the General Overseas Service of the BBC.
Hello everyone, I'm Keith Parent, and welcome again to another edition of Media Network Plus from PCJ Radio International. We begin with China, a country where many journalists are simply giving up on the profession. Because of tougher controls and censorship under the leadership of Xi Jinping, this is forcing many of them out of the business. They're finding the small space they once had to question and investigate is closing, and now the only option is to be a mouthpiece for the party. Since Xi Jinping actually took power, there actually have been a lot of changes. People would say a lot of changes for the worst. Or, as they say in China, for every step taken forward, there's five steps taken backwards. Matthew Carney reports from Beijing.
Each night at 7 p.m., 140 million people tune into China Central TV's flagship news program. It's still probably the most watched news bulletin on earth, and the format hasn't changed in 40 years. There's story after story of what President Xi Jinping did for the nation and the people. The Communist Party has long used the media as its tool. As Chairman Mao famously declared, the revolution relies on pens and guns. But China's president, Xi Jinping, has taken this adage to a new level. In his drive to overturn the collective leadership that's emerged in China in the last couple of decades to return it to one-man rule. Xi recently visited newsrooms of the state media outlets and reminded them of what their role was. David Bandersky is an expert on Chinese journalism from the University of Hong Kong.
We love the party, protect the party, and serve the party. And this was an unambiguous message of party control, such as we've never seen since in the reform period. So we hadn't seen this under Deng quite this way. We hadn't seen it certainly under Jiang Zemin and under Hu Jintao. So really, it was quite unprecedented.
Since Xi Jinping became leader, the government has launched an all-out assault on freedom of expression, jailing journalists, bloggers, and outspoken civil rights lawyers. On the Reporters Without Borders press freedom ranking, China now occupies 176th position out of 180 countries.
We're seeing a lot more pessimism because it's impossible to do just about anything. It used to be that journalists had a kind of wiggle room. Journalists were finding a way to do stories. In fact, in some cases, they were finding a way to do exposés, investigative pieces of a quality that we would see outside China, internationally. World-class journalism was happening in China.
Many journalists can't see the point anymore. David Bandersky says there's an exodus of talented journalists leaving the profession.
The political environment is so tight right now that it's impossible to do anything professionally. So if you see yourself as a journalist, a professional journalist who wants to get the story, who wants to make your publication succeed, then your hands are basically tied and they can only deal with that frustration for so long.
This journalist worked at a prominent state media outlet for 4 years. He wants to remain unidentified as he fears reprisals. He says reporters have little choice but to be a mouthpiece for the government.
我认为言论的环境是在收紧的。
The general control of speech is tightening. It's a negative influence on reporting. I don't see any sign of it loosening up. All Chinese journalists are experiencing this problem.
When he covered recent workers' protests in China's coal belt, he had troubles getting his work published. But digging deeper into working conditions and company accounts was not acceptable.
I went to the northeast of China to cover a workers' strike. On the third day, I was required to draw back from it by an order from the Department of Publicity, and I was not allowed to do any follow-up reports.
He says there's a darker side to Chinese journalism that few people talk about. Many of his colleagues have been offered bribes, intimidated or threatened with violence by government or business.He says one of his colleagues was forced to leave China because of the threats.
企业的威胁可能是
Threats from entrepreneurs could be, we will send people to beat you up, we know the address of your home, and we know where you work. And threats from government officials could be, you're not acting in accordance with the publicity regulations, or we will take care of you later if you keep acting like this.
He became a journalist to change China and make it a better place.But he's realized that's not possible, so now he's just taken a job in public relations. Another Chinese journalist who wants to remain unidentified is still working in senior roles in Chinese state media. He says an intricate multi-layered system of censorship has developed over the decades of one-party rule, and it starts with oneself.
国内媒体现在已经形成了一种风格，就是在这个稿子操作之前。
The domestic media has formed a custom which is to evaluate the risk of story proposals before starting them. We call it self-castration. We would think whether we can publish it and the possible risks if we publish it.
The journalists we spoke to are not optimistic about the future and despair of Xi Jinping's ever-growing shadow over the profession.And his quest for absolute control.
There is a trend for journalists to leave this industry, and many are disappointed. Journalism is supported by dreams and emotions, but the dreams have been broken. Many capable people have left this industry, and the ability to investigate has been shut down.
That story came to us from Matthew Carney in Beijing. We now head to Singapore.Media experts say the 10-month jail sentence handed to an Australian in Singapore will have a chilling effect on other journalists in the country. Ai Tajiki was the Australian-based editor and owner of the Real Singapore website. It was popular and profitable, but it was shut down after she and her Singaporean husband were arrested on a visit to the island last year. They've been charged with sedation, which...The Southeast Asia Press Alliance says is extremely rare for journalists in Singapore. Meredith Griffith reports.
The Real Singapore, or TRS, was one of the larger independent news sites in the island nation, and its popularity generated advertising revenue. But the site was shut down last year when authorities accused its owners of trying to incite anti-foreigner sentiments. Associate Professor Joseph Fernandez teaches media law at Curtin University and has been following the case of the site's Australian-based editor and owner, Ai Takagi.
He named a particular group as being responsible for causing some disturbance at a Hindu festival.
23-year-old Ai Takagi pleaded guilty to 4 charges, including fabricating some stories.
I'm a little surprised that Ai Takagi did not realise that she was sailing very close to the wind.
Nevertheless, Associate Professor Fernandez says 10 months in prison is way too much for something that cannot be quantified in terms of actual harm.
She's pregnant of several weeks. One would have thought that those factors would be taken into account. And also looking back at earlier instances when the sedition provisions were used, people have been given much lighter sentences.Including probation and severe reprimand. So this is one of the more severe instances of punishment for breaching that act.
No other journalists are currently in prison in Singapore, but Associate Professor Fernandez says Aya Takagi's sentence will have a chilling effect on other journalists in the country, especially those working for the dozen or so independent news websites.
There's no doubt that the authorities in Singapore decided to make an example of Aya Takagi, and they went for the jugular, picked the most severe of the laws.
The Southeast Asian Press Alliance says it's rare for Singaporean journalists to be charged with sedition, so it's alarmed that authorities took that step. The Alliance's Executive Director, Edla Gaspi, says normally journalists are charged with defamation or other softer charges.
It's more common for the online journalists, bloggers, to run into the law for some reason or another, because they're the ones who are giving vent to the more controversial, more provocative issues in the context of Singapore and its politics and society. So there has been a few, but not recently. The government has been trying over the years to regulate them, like, because they don't really fall under the Printing and Publications Registration Act. So there are a few measures that they were trying to do, like, for example, classify organizations as political organizations so that they are prevented from soliciting advertisements or donations from foreigners. So those kinds of restrictions we have seen in Singapore over the years.
So is it getting harder for independent news websites to set up and run in Singapore?
I guess it's not hard to start up, but once you get the government's attention, things can get pretty hard.
Aya Takagi's Singaporean husband has pleaded not guilty to similar charges as his wife and is due to face court next week.
This week in the news, there were two big stories that the media worldwide was covering. First was the terrorist attack that took place in Brussels, the Belgian capital. Happening at exactly the same time was US President Barack Obama's visit to Cuba, the first American president to visit the island in 88 years. Now, many people would consider Cuba the last bastion of the Cold War. While things changed in Eastern Europe and Russia, Cuba was the last thing that, well, the Cold War mentality was still going on. One of the stations that broadcast to Cuba on a daily basis with a number of hours is Radio Martí. There's also a TV service called TV Martí. Now, since the inception of these two stations, they have been constantly jammed by the Cubans. Mind you, there is somewhat of an audience in Cuba because jamming, of course, is not 100% perfect. Jason Margot has visited Radio Martí in Miami, Florida, and filed this report.
And here you have journalists that work on all three of our platforms.
On first impression, Radio and TV Martí looks and feels like pretty much any other newsroom.
You're going to see a number of our radio studios.
Emilio Vasquez shows me around. We watch two radio broadcasters behind a thick pane of glass.
We have a morning show known as El Revoltillo, which is like an on-air swap market type of show where people call in and offer different products and services for sale on island.
But here's what's very different about this call-in show. It's illegal for its listeners to call in, or even to listen. That is, if they even can. The Cuban government tries to jam broadcast signals coming from Florida. Vasquez says they're always trying to stay one step ahead.
We have various methods of transmission. We have medium-wave transmission on AM frequency. We have our short-wave transmissions.
Those change frequencies throughout the course of the day. Vasquez starts to tell me some other tricks when we run into his boss, Malule Gonzalez.
Malule Gonzalez.
How are you?
Good, how are you?
Nice. So sorry, we're running a bit late.
That's okay.
On our way up to her office, we stop for shots of hyper-potent Cuban coffees. Gonzalez is the director of the Office of Cuba Broadcasting, the official name of Radio and TV Martí. She tells me more about how their TV content gets out in Cuba. On the island, vendors on the street sell what's called El Paquete, thumb drives or DVDs with movies, music, or videos.
We have our own paquete. We create our own distribution of DVDs.
So you have your ways.
We have our ways, yeah. We have more ways than that one, but there are many things that you don't reveal because they monitor everything that we do or say. I'm not going to give them all. It's just like the magician. He never reveals the tricks, no?
They're currently handing out about 16,000 paquetes a month in Cuba. Gonzalez is confident their shows are being seen, but she has no way to prove it. Nobody does. There aren't Nielsen ratings. Past surveys suggest the audience for the Martiz is quite small, perhaps as low as 2% of the island. But anecdotal evidence suggests otherwise. Uva de Aragon is a retired professor who was also a commentator for 15 years on Radio Martí. She told me about a time she got in a cab in Havana in the late 90s.
This taxi driver was amazing because he heard me talk to my sister and he said, "Excuse me that I ask you, but do you talk in a radio show?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "You talk in Radio Martí?" And I say, "Yes." He says, "Your name, Uva de Aragon?" It was my second day in Havana after 40 years.
That was a while ago, though. It's a much different world in Cuba today, says Eduardo Gamarra with Florida International University.
Cuba is now able to access the internet more freely than it did just a year ago. Telecommunications is penetrating Cuba much more quickly than people expected. But it's also true that Cubans still don't have free access to global information.
In fact, by some estimates, only 5% of Cubans actually have access to the internet. Still, critics question if Cubans are getting the best information from the Martiz. They call the programming one-dimensional, conservative, a mouthpiece of American policy. Gamarra says he's staunchly disagreed with many editorials broadcast by the Martiz.
But I think the criticism of them that because they're conservative, they're not good journalists, doesn't follow. They still have some value. I think it has an expiration date, though.
When that expiration date should be is the big question. With a thaw in U.S.-Cuba relations, some say the time is now. A Democratic congresswoman introduced a bill to end the Martiz. It's called the Stop Wasting Taxpayer Money on Cuba Broadcasting Act. The Martiz costs U.S. taxpayers $27 million a year. President Obama wants to turn the Martiz into an independent nonprofit, but still funded by the government. Many conservatives say that would weaken the government's commitment. They say the Martiz still provide an invaluable service exposing human rights abuses in Cuba. Malule Gonzalez says her operation is more important than ever, even with President Obama on the island today.
Don't be confused by people shaking hands. That doesn't mean that the Cuban people has any freedom.
But she says she hopes the day will come when radio and TV Martí are no longer needed. And when that happens, she'll be happy to shut things down.
So if we're out of a job, well, then I'll call you and send my resume. But out of a job, but celebrating.
Jason Margolis, Miami.
Thanks, Jason. Now, I'd like to actually talk for a moment about Radio Havana, Cuba. Because a lot of people, including myself, have been saying that when things change, what is going to be Radio Havana Cuba's purpose? Now, we have to put the station into a little bit of context. The station actually began because of the Bay of Pigs invasion in May 1961. The station actually has come a long way from what it originally was. Back in the 1960s, they would actually broadcast programs from Vietnam and the North Koreans. And how this was done is the scripts were sent over, and then they would have Radio Havana Cuba announcers read the scripts. The station, of course, in the 1970s and 1980s, was, well, a Cold War station, but very different from Radio Moscow. Radio Havana Cuba became known for its music that it played. But over the years, especially over the last 25 years since the Cold War disappeared and the collapse of the Soviet Union, the station has been trying to find a purpose. Now, there was a time when stations like Radio Moscow would even transmit to the Americas through Cuba. Well, that ended. But in recent years, China has been using transmitters from Radio Havana, Cuba to reach its audiences in Latin America, the Caribbean, and North America. But the question now is, can Radio Havana, Cuba actually continue on the path that they're doing right now? Now, we have seen over the last 15 years, even in the last 5 years, a lot of cuts at major international broadcasters, some stations discontinuing programming altogether. For example, Radio Netherlands. Deutsche Welle's had cuts in languages, and so have other stations as well. Radio Havana Cuba, which broadcast in a number of languages, has actually seen their transmission output reduced. Now, they still maintain transmissions to Europe, the Middle East, and North America. But even these transmissions are becoming harder to hear, in part because of the old Soviet-made transmitters that they're operating, of which parts are very few. And I remember my time at Radio Havana Cuba, the engineers always had great difficulty in keeping some of those old transmitters on the air. Anyway, those problems still persist today. When I was at Radio Havana Cuba, and for a long time, they would broadcast a two-hour program to North America that was repeated three times to cover the three different time zones. This program is now cut down to 1 hour. The reason for the cut was not really budget, but staffing problems. Radio Havana Cuba does have a problem getting staff. To give you an idea of what the salaries are like at Radio Havana Cuba, and it hasn't really changed that much since I was there, but for Cuban staff, it was around 125 Cuban pesos a month, which is not very much money. For the foreign staff, it was around 350 Cuban pesos, which at the time had an exchange rate of around $10 to $15 US. It should be mentioned that a doctor in Cuba makes somewhere around 350 Cuban pesos, so that's not very much. Mind you, housing is also included in that, as well as a few other things. So getting foreign staff to come to Radio Havana Cuba has always been challenging, and has become more challenging in the last few years because they no longer pay also a hard currency allowance. The hard currency allowance when I was at Radio Havana Cuba was 50 US dollars a month. It's now less than that. A lot of young journalists in Cuba who speak English and maybe had dreams of working at Radio Havana Cuba only end up staying at the station for about 2 years, partially because of the money. They end up going to work in the tourist section where they can make 10 times the money that they make at Radio Havana Cuba. The other issue that is going to arise with the changing of the relationship between Cuba and the United States is Radio Havana Cuba's mandate. If you listen to programming from the 70s, 80s, 90s, and even today, it's always focused on the United States. Now, I'm focusing now on the English language section. So if the relationship changes, obviously the mandate also has to change. But how do you change a mandate to a station overnight? Well, you see, this is the problem. It takes money, and you also have to hire new staff to do it. Now, Radio Havana Cuba also broadcasts programs in Guarani to Uruguay and Quechua to South America, which is listened to in Bolivia. But even these two language sections are having problems reaching their audience, mainly because of the technology changes. Now, we've seen, of course, huge technology changes take place just in the last 3 years alone. There's so many different ways to reach an audience. But Radio Havana Cuba, like, let's say, Voice of Korea, are predominantly using short wave. They're not using FM relays, and they're not streaming stuff online. And this is causing a problem, because stations that continue to use one form of distribution are being left behind. Back in 1995, there was discussion at Radio Havana Cuba to have its programs relayed on FM stations in Europe and North America. But the problem was, which stations would even relay the programs? It had nothing to do with the embargo. It had more to do with the quality output of the sound that they were using, and also how to get the programs to these stations. This is a problem that still persists at Radio Havana Cuba. Today, in 2016, just like in 1996 and 2006, the vast majority of computers in the Radio Havana Cuba newsroom are donated computers. They didn't stop using tape until a few years ago. In fact, tape is still used at Radio Havana, Cuba. So, will the station continue as soon as the embargo is lifted? Now, the embargo hasn't been lifted yet. The first step, of course, is establishing diplomatic relations. The next step, of course, would be Congress voting on lifting the embargo, which is going to be quite challenging. Many people, including myself, have speculated that as soon as the embargo is lifted, Radio Havana Cuba's days are numbered. How long can Radio Havana Cuba really continue? Well, there are estimates. Estimates of 5 to 6 years after the embargo was lifted. Some say even less, possibly even 1 year after the embargo was lifted. Some other people are saying that what could happen is that they will cease all shortwave transmissions and just provide an online service. Well, the only thing I can say is we'll have to wait and see. It's now time to turn our attention to propagation and what has been happening and what we can expect. Here's Glenn Hauser.
Keith from IPS in Australia, the global HF propagation forecast through March 26th, normal at all latitudes. From Space Weather South Africa through March 26th, magnetic conditions quiet, shortwave fadeouts unlikely, MUF unstable. From Met Office UK through March 27th, solar activity expected to remain very low, with about a 30% chance of common class flares, and only a 5% chance of moderate class flares. Geomagnetic activity mainly quiet to unsettled, with a chance of isolated active intervals from late on the 26th onwards. From Peter Coleman of the Czech Propagation Interest Group, the geomagnetic field will be quiet on March 25th and 26th, quiet to unsettled on March 27th, 30th, April 5th, 6th, and 13th. Mostly quiet on March 31st, April 1st, and 9th. Quiet to active on March 28th, 29th, April 4th, 7th, and 8th. Active to disturbed on April 2nd, 3rd, 10th, 11th, and 12th. From SWPC in Boulder, geomagnetic activity expected to reach G2 moderate storm levels on April 2nd, and Candace's peaking at 30 and 6, with G1 minor storm levels expected April 3rd and 11th to 13th, and Candace's reaching 24 and 5. Solar flux rising from 85 March 24th to only 95 April 4th to 11th. William Hepburn's VHF UHF DX maps show extreme tropospheric ducting along the west coast of India all week and the east coast until March 27th, plus the northwest coast of Australia, March 27th to 29th.
Thanks, Glenn, and that's all we have time for on this week's edition of the program. Our email address is mnp@pcjmedia.com. We'll see you in 7 days' time, 73 and 88 to the ladies.